Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Voyager by Diana Gabaldon, narrated by Davina Porter and directed by Kathleen Gormley. This book is copyrighted 1994 by Diana Gabaldon. This recording is copyrighted 1999 by Recorded Books. In 1745, Charles Stuart, great-grandson of James II and pretender to the throne of Scotland, sailed from exile in France to his homeland to raise an army of followers among the clans. The uprising, known as the 45, swept victoriously across the countryside, capturing Edinburgh in September and briefly invading England itself in November. But in April 1746, their brief flame was extinguished, for the followers of Bonnie Prince Charlie were utterly destroyed by the army of the Duke of Cumberland on the grey wastes of Culloden Moor. Nary a soul was left alive. And now, Voyager.
Prologue. When I was small, I never wanted to step in puddles. Not because of any fear of drowned worms or wet stockings. I was, by and large, a grubby child, with a blissful disregard for filth of any kind. It was because I couldn't bring myself to believe that that perfect smooth expanse was no more than a thin film of water over solid earth. I believed it was an opening into some fathomless space. Sometimes, seeing the tiny ripples caused by my approach, I thought the puddle impossibly deep, a bottomless sea in which the lazy coil of tentacle and gleam of scale lay hidden, with the threat of huge bodies and sharp teeth adrift and silent in the far-down depths. And then, looking down into reflection, I would see my own round face and frizzled hair against a featureless blue sweep, and think instead that the puddle was the entrance to another sky. If I stepped in there, I would drop at once and keep on falling, on and on, into blue space. The only time I would dare to walk through a puddle was at twilight, when the evening stars came out. If I looked in the water and saw one lighted pinprick there, I could splash through unafraid. For if I should fall into the puddle and on into space, I could grab hold of the star as I passed and be safe. Even now, when I see a puddle in my path, my mind half halts, though my feet do not, then hurries on, with only the echo of the thought left behind. What if, this time, you fall? Part 1. Battle and the Loves of Men. Chapter 1. The Corby's Feast. Many a Highland chieftain fought. Many a gallant man did fall. Death itself were dearly bought, all for Scotland's king and law. Will ye no come back again? April the 16th, 1746. He was dead. However, his nose throbbed painfully, which he thought odd in the circumstances. While he placed considerable trust in the understanding and mercy of his Creator, he harboured that residue of elemental guilt that made all men fear the chance of hell. Still, all he had ever heard of hell made him think it unlikely that the torments reserved for its luckless inhabitants could be restricted to a sore nose. On the other hand, this couldn't be heaven, on several counts. For one, he didn't deserve it. For another, it didn't look it. And for a third, he doubted that the rewards of the blessed included a broken nose, any more than those of the damned. While he had always thought of purgatory as a grey sort of place, the faint reddish light that hid everything around him seemed suitable. His mind was clearing a bit, and his power to reason was coming back, if slowly. Someone, he thought rather crossly, ought to see him and tell him just what the sentence was, until he should have suffered enough to be purified, and at last to enter the kingdom of God. Whether he was expecting a demon or an angel was uncertain. He had no idea of the staffing requirements of purgatory. It wasn't a matter the Dominie had addressed in his schooldays. While waiting, he began to take stock of whatever other torments he might be required to endure. There were numerous cuts, gashes, and bruises here and there, and he was fairly sure he'd broken the fourth finger of his right hand again. Difficult to protect it, the way it stuck out so stiff, with the joint frozen. None of that was too bad, though. What else? Claire. The name knifed across his heart with a pain that was more racking than anything his body had ever been called on to withstand. If he had had an actual body any more, he was sure it would have doubled up in agony. He had known it would be like this when he sent her back to the stone circle. Spiritual anguish could be taken as a standard condition in purgatory, and he had expected all along that the pain of separation would be his chief punishment. Sufficient, he thought, to atone for anything he'd ever done, murder and betrayal included. He didn't know whether persons in purgatory were allowed to pray or not, but tried anyway. Lord, he prayed, that she may be safe, she and the child. He was sure she would have made it to the circle itself. Only 2 months gone with child, she was still light and fleet of foot, and the most stubbornly determined woman he had ever met. But whether she had managed the dangerous transition back to the place from which she had come, sliding precariously through whatever mysterious layers lay between then and now, powerless in the grip of the rock, that he could never know, and the thought of it was enough to make him forget even the throbbing in his nose. He resumed his interrupted inventory of bodily ills, and became inordinately distressed at the discovery that his left leg appeared to be missing. Sensation stopped at the hip, with a sort of pins and needles tingling at the joint. Presumably, he would get it back in due time, either when he finally arrived in heaven, or at the least, at Judgment Day. And after all, his brother-in-law, Ian, managed very well on the wooden peg he wore to replace his missing leg. Still, his vanity was troubled. Ah, that must be it. A punishment meant to cure him of the sin of vanity. He mentally set his teeth, determined to accept whatever came to him with fortitude and such humility as he could manage. Still, he couldn't help reaching an exploratory hand, whatever he was using for a hand, tentatively downward, to see just where the limb now ended. The hand struck something hard, and the fingers tangled in wet, snarled hair. He sat up abruptly, and with some effort cracked the layer of dried blood that had sealed his eyelid shut. Memory flooded back, and he groaned aloud. He had been mistaken. This was hell. But James Fraser was unfortunately not dead, after all. The body of a man lay across his own. Its dead weight crushed his left leg, explaining the absence of feeling. The head, heavy as a spent cannonball, pressed face down into his abdomen, the damp matted hair a dark spill on the wet linen of his shirt. He jerked upward in sudden panic. The head rolled sideways into his lap, and a half-open eye stared sightlessly up behind the sheltering strands of hair. It was Jack Randall, his fine red captain's coat so dark with the wet it looked almost black. Jamie made a fumbling effort to push the body away, but found himself amazingly weak. His hand splayed feebly against Randall's shoulder, and the elbow of his other arm buckled suddenly as he tried to support himself. He found himself lying once more flat on his back, the sleeting sky pale grey and whirling dizzily overhead. Jack Randall's head moved obscenely up and down on his stomach with each gasping breath. He pressed his hands flat against the boggy ground. The water rose up cold through his fingers and soaked the back of his shirt, and wriggled sideways. Some warmth was trapped between them. As the limp, dead weight slid slowly free, the freezing rain struck his newly exposed flesh with a shock like a blow, and he shivered violently with sudden chill. As he squirmed on the ground, struggling with the crumpled, mud-stained folds of his plaid, he could hear sounds above the keening of the April wind. Far-off shouts, and a moaning and wailing like the calling of ghosts in the wind. And over all, the raucous calling of crows. Dozens of crows from the sound. That was strange, he thought dimly. Birds shouldn't fly in a storm like this. A final heave freed the plaid from under him, and he fumbled it over his body. As he reached to cover his legs, he saw that his kilt and left leg were soaked with blood. The sight didn't distress him. It seemed only vaguely interesting. The dark red smears a contrast to the greyish-green of the moor plants around him. The echoes of battle faded from his ears, and he left Culloden Field to the calling of the crows. He was wakened much later by the calling of his name.
Fraser! Jamie Fraser! Are ye here?
No, he thought groggily.
I'm not.
Wherever he had been while unconscious, it was a better place than this. He lay in a small declivity, half filled with water. The sleeting rain had stopped, but the wind hadn't. It whined over the moor, piercing and chilling. The sky had darkened nearly to black. It must be near evening, then.
I saw him go down here, I tell you, right near a big clump of gorse.
The voice was at a distance, fading as it argued with someone. There was a rustle near his ear, and he turned his head to see the crow. It stood on the grass, a foot away, a blotch of wind-ruffled black feathers, regarding him with a bead-bright eye. Deciding that he posed no threat, it swiveled its neck with casual ease and jabbed its thick, sharp bill into Jack Randall's eye. Jamie jerked up with a cry of revulsion and a flurry of movement that sent the crow flapping off, squawking with alarm.
"Aye, over there!"
There was a squelching through boggy ground, and a face before him, and the welcome feel of a hand on his shoulder.
"He's alive! Come on, MacDonald! You'll lend a hand here. He'll no be walking on his own."
There were four of them, and with a good deal of effort they got him up, arms draped helpless about the shoulders of Ewan Cameron and Ian McKinnon. He wanted to tell them to leave him. His purpose had returned to him with the waking, and he remembered that he had meant to die. But the sweetness of their company was too much to resist. The rest had restored the feeling in his dead leg, and he knew the seriousness of the wound. He would die soon in any case. Thank God, it needn't be alone, in the dark.
Water.
The edge of the cup pressed against his lip, and he roused himself long enough to drink, careful not to spill it. A hand pressed briefly against his forehead and dropped away without comment. He was burning. He could feel the flames behind his eyes when he closed them. His lips were cracked and sore from the heat, but it was better than the chills that came at intervals. At least when he was fevered, he could lie still. The shaking of the chills woke the sleeping demons in his leg.
Murto.
He had a terrible feeling about his godfather, but no memory to give it shape. Murto was dead. He knew that must be it, but didn't know why or how he knew. A good half of the Highland army was dead, slaughtered on the moor. So much he had gathered from the talk of the men in the farmhouse, but he had no memory of the battle himself. He had fought with armies before, and knew such loss of memory wasn't uncommon in soldiers. He had seen it, though never before suffered it himself. He knew the memories would come back, and hoped he would be dead before they did. He shifted at the thought, and the movement sent a jolt of white-hot pain through his leg that made him groan.
All right, Jamie.
Ewan rose on one elbow next to him, worried face worn in the dawning light. A blood-stained bandage circled his head, and there were rusty stains on his collar from the scalp wound left by a bullet's graze.
Aye, I'll do.
He reached up a hand and touched Ewan's shoulder in gratitude. Ewan patted it and lay back down. The crows were back. Black as night themselves, they had gone to roost with the darkness. But with the dawn, they were back, birds of war. The Corbies had come to feast on the flesh of the fallen.
It could as well be his own eyes the cruel beaks picked out, he thought.
He could feel the shape of his eyeballs beneath his lids, round and hot, tasty bits of jelly rolling restless to and fro, looking vainly for oblivion, while the rising sun turned his lids a dark and bloody red. Four of the men were gathered near the single window of the farmhouse, talking quietly together.
"Make a run for it," one said with a nod outside. "Christ, man, the best of us can barely stagger, and there's six at least canna walk at all." "If you can go, be going," said a man from the floor.
He grimaced toward his own leg, wrapped in the remains of a tattered quilt.
"Dinna linger on our account."
Duncan MacDonald turned from the window with a grim smile, shaking his head. The window's light shone off the rough planes of his face, deepening the lines of fatigue.
"Nay, we'll bide," he said. "For one thing, the English are thick as lice on the ground. You can see them swarm from the window. There's no man would get away whole from Dromossie now. Even those that fled the field yesterday will no get far," MacKinnon put in softly. "Did you no hear the English troops passing in the night at the quick march? Do you think it will be hard for them to hunt down our ragtag lot?"
There was no response to this. All of them knew the answer too well. Many of the Highlanders had been barely able to stand on the field before the battle, weakened as they were by cold, fatigue, and hunger. Jamie turned his face to the wall, praying that his men had started early enough. Lallybroch was remote. If they could get far enough from Culloden, it was unlikely they would be caught. And yet Clare had told him that Cumberland's troops would ravage the Highlands, ranging far afield in their thirst for revenge. The thought of her this time caused only a wave of terrible longing.
God, to have her here, to lay her hands on him, to tend his wounds and cradle his head in her lap.
But she was gone. Gone away 200 years from him.
And thank the Lord that she was.
Tears trickled slowly from under his closed lids, and he rolled painfully onto his side, to hide them from the others.
"Lord, that she might be safe," he prayed. "She and the child."
Toward mid-afternoon, the smell of burning came suddenly on the air, wafting through the glassless window. It was thicker than the smell of black powder smoke, pungent, with an underlying odour that was faintly horrible in its reminiscent smell of roasting meat.
"They are burning the dead," said MacDonald.
He had scarcely moved from his seat by the window in all the time they had been in the cottage. He looked like a death's head himself, hair coal black and matted with dirt, scraped back from a face in which every bone showed. Here and there, a small flat crack sounded on the moor. Gunshots. The coup de grâce, administered by those English officers with a sense of compassion before a tartan-clad wretch should be stacked on the pyre with his luckier fellows. When Jamie looked up, Duncan MacDonald still sat by the window, but his eyes were closed. Next to him, Ewan Cameron crossed himself.
"May we find as much mercy," he whispered,
They did. It was just past noon on the second day when booted feet at last approached the farmhouse, and the door swung open on silent leather hinges.
Christ!
It was a muttered exclamation at the sight within the farmhouse. The draught from the door stirred the fetid air over grimed, bedraggled, blood-stained bodies that lay or sat huddled on the packed dirt floor. There had been no discussion of the possibility of armed resistance. They had no heart, and there was no point. The Jacobites simply sat, waiting the pleasure of their visitor. He was a major, all fresh and new, in an uncreased uniform with polished boots. After a moment's hesitation to survey the inhabitants, he stepped inside, his lieutenant close behind. "I am Lord Melton," he said, glancing around, as though seeking the leader of these men, to whom his remarks might most properly be addressed. Duncan MacDonald, after a glance of his own, stood slowly and inclined his head. "Duncan MacDonald of Glen Ritchie," he said. "And others," he waved a hand, "late of the forces of His Majesty, King James." "So I surmised," the Englishman said dryly. He was young, in his early 30s, but he carried himself with a seasoned soldier's confidence. He looked deliberately from man to man, then reached into his coat and produced a folded sheet of paper. "I have here an order from His Grace the Duke of Cumberland," he said, "authorising the immediate execution of any man found to have engaged in the treasonous rebellion just past." He glanced around the confines of the cottage once more. "Is there any man here who claims innocence of treason?" There was the faintest breath of laughter from the Scots. Innocence, with the smoke of battle still black on their faces, here on the edge of the slaughter field. "No, my lord," said MacDonald, the faintest of smiles on his lips. "Traitors all. Shall we be hanged, then?" Melton's face twitched in a small grimace of distaste, then settled back into impassivity. He was a slight man, with small, fine bones, but carried his authority well, nonetheless. "You will be shot," he said. "You have an hour in which to prepare yourselves." He hesitated, shooting a glance at his lieutenant, as though afraid to sound over-generous before his subordinate, but continued, "If any of you wish writing materials, to compose a letter, perhaps, the clerk of my company will attend you." He nodded briefly to MacDonald, turned on his heel, and left. It was a grim hour. A few men availed themselves of the offer of pen and ink, and scribbled doggedly, paper held against the slanted wood chimney for lack of another firm writing surface. Others prayed quietly, or simply sat, waiting. MacDonald had begged mercy for Giles MacMartin and Frederick Murray, arguing that they were barely 17, and shouldn't be held to the same account as their elders. This request was denied, and the boys sat together, white-faced against the wall, holding each other's hands. For them, Jamie felt a piercing sorrow, and for the others here, loyal friends and gallant soldiers. For himself, he felt only relief. No more to worry, nothing more to do. He had done all he could for his men, his wife, his unborn child. Now let this bodily misery be ended, and he would go, grateful for the peace of it. More for form's sake than because he felt the need of it, he closed his eyes and began the act of contrition in French, as he always said it. "Mon Dieu, je regrette." And yet he didn't. It was much too late for any sort of regret. Would he find Claire at once when he died? He wondered. Or perhaps, as he expected, be condemned to separation for a time. In any case, he would see her again. He clung to the conviction much more firmly than he embraced the tenets of the church. God had given her to him. He would restore her. Forgetting to pray, He instead began to conjure her face behind his eyelids, the curve of cheek and temple, a broad, fair brow that always moved him to kiss it, just there, in that small, smooth spot between her eyebrows, just at the top of her nose, between clear, amber eyes. He fixed his attention on the shape of her mouth, carefully imagining the full, sweet curve of it, and the taste and the feel and the joy of it. The sounds of praying, the pen scratching, and the small choked sobs of Giles McMartin faded from his ears. It was mid-afternoon when Melton returned, this time with 6 soldiers in attendance, as well as the lieutenant and the clerk. Again he paused in the doorway, but MacDonald rose before he could speak. "I'll go first," he said, and walked steadily across the cottage. As he bent his head to go through the door, though, Lord Melton laid a hand on his sleeve.
"Will you give your full name, sir? My clerk will make note of it."
MacDonald glanced at the clerk, a small bitter smile tugging at the corner of his mouth.
"A trophy list, is it? Aye, well."
He shrugged and drew himself upright.
"Duncan William MacLeod MacDonald of Glenritchie."
He bowed politely to Lord Melton.
"At your service, sir."
He passed through the door, and shortly there came the sound of a single pistol shot from near at hand. The boys were allowed to go together, hands still clutched tightly as they passed through the door. The rest were taken one by one. Each asked for his name, that the clerk might make a record of it. The clerk sat on a stool by the door, head bent to the papers in his lap, not looking up as the men passed by. When it came to Ewan's turn, Jamie struggled to prop himself on his elbows and grasped his friend's hand as hard as he could.
"I shall see you soon again," he whispered.
Ewan's hand shook in his, but the Cameron only smiled. Then he leaned across simply and kissed Jamie's mouth and rose to go. They left the 6 who could not walk to the last.
"James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser," he said,
speaking slowly to allow the clerk time to get it down right.
"Laird of Brochturach."
Patiently he spelled it, then glanced up at Milton.
"I must ask your courtesy, my lord, to give me help to stand."
Melton didn't answer him, but stared down at him, his expression of remote distaste altering to one of mingled astonishment and something like dawning horror.
"Fraser," he said, "of Brochturach?"
"I am,"
Jamie said patiently. Would the man not hurry a bit? Being resigned to being shot was one thing, but listening to your friends being killed in your hearing was another, and not just calculated to settle the nerves. His arms were trembling with the strain of propping him, and his bowels, not sharing the resignation of his higher faculties, were twitching with a gurgling dread.
"Bloody hell," the Englishman muttered.
He bent and peered at Jamie where he lay in the shadow of the wall, then turned and beckoned to his lieutenant.
"Help me get him into the light," he ordered.
They weren't gentle about it, and Jamie grunted as the movement sent a bolt of pain from his leg right up through the top of his head. It made him dizzy for a moment, and he missed what Melton was saying to him.
"Are you the Jacobite they call Red Jamie?" he asked again, impatiently.
A streak of fear went through Jamie at that. Let them know he was the notorious Red Jamie, and they wouldn't shoot him.
They'd take him in chains to London to be tried.
A prize of war. And after that, it would be the hangman's rope, and lying half-strangled on the gallows platform while they slit his belly and ripped out his bowels. His bowels gave another long, rumbling gurgle. They didn't think much of the notion either.
"No,"
he said, with as much firmness as he could manage.
"Just get on with it, eh?"
Ignoring this, Melton dropped to his knees and ripped open the throat of Jamie's shirt. He gripped Jamie's hair and jerked back his head. "Damn," Melton said. Melton's finger prodded him in the throat, just above the collarbone. There was a small triangular scar there, and this appeared to be what was causing his interrogator's concern.
"James Fraser of Broch Turoch, red hair and a three-cornered scar on his throat."
Melton let go of the hair and sat back on his heels, rubbing his chin in a distracted sort of way. Then he pulled himself together and turned to the lieutenant, gesturing at the five men remaining in the farm cottage.
"Take the rest," he ordered.
His fair brows were knitted together in a deep frown. He stood over Jamie, scowling, while the other Scottish prisoners were removed.
"I have to think," he muttered. "Damn me, I must think."
"Do that," said Jamie, "if you're able. I must lie down myself."
They had propped him sitting against the far wall, his legs stretched out in front of him, but sitting upright after 2 days of lying flat was more than he could manage. The room was tilting drunkenly, and small flashing lights kept coming before his eyes. He leaned to one side and eased himself down, hugging the dirt floor, eyes closed as he waited for the dizziness to pass. Melton was muttering under his breath, but Jamie couldn't make out the words. Didn't care greatly in any case. Sitting up in the sunlight, he had seen his leg clearly for the first time, and he was fairly sure that he wouldn't live long enough to be hanged. The deep, angry red of inflammation spread from mid-thigh upward, much brighter than the remaining smears of dried blood. The wound itself was purulent. With the stench of the other men lessening, he could smell the faint, sweet, foul odour of the discharge. Still, a quick bullet through the head seemed much preferable to the pain and delirium of death by infection. "Did you hear the bang?" he wondered. And drifted off, the cool, pounded dirt smooth and comforting as a mother's breast under his hot cheek. He wasn't really asleep, only drifting in a feverish doze. But Melton's voice in his ear jerked him to alertness.
"Gray," the voice was saying. "John William Gray. Do you know that name?"
"No," he said, mazy with sleep and fever. "Look, man, either shoot me or go away, aye? I'm ill."
"Near Carry Arrick," Melton's voice was prodding, impatient. "A boy, a fair-haired boy, about 16. You met him in the wood."
Jamie squinted up at his tormentor. The fever distorted his vision, but there seemed something vaguely familiar about the fine-boned face above him, with those large, almost girlish eyes.
"Oh," he said,
catching a single face from the flood of images that swirled erratically through his brain.
"The wee laddie that tried to kill me. Aye, I mind him."
He closed his eyes again. In the odd way of fever, one sensation seemed to blend into another. He had broken John William Gray's arm. The memory of the boy's fine bone beneath his hand became the bone of Claire's forearm as he tore her from the grip of the stones. The cool, misty breeze stroked his face with Claire's fingers.
"Wake up, damn you!"
His head snapped on his neck as Melton shook him impatiently.
"Listen to me!"
Jamie opened his eyes wearily.
"Aye."
"John William Gray is my brother," Melton said. "He told me of his meeting with you. You spared his life, and he made you a promise. Is that true?"
With great effort, he cast his mind back. He had met the boy 2 days before the first battle of the rebellion, the Scottish victory at Prestonpans. The 6 months between then and now seemed a vast chasm. So much had happened in between.
I recall. He promised to kill me.
I dinna mind if you do it for him, though.
His eyelids were drooping again. Did he have to be awake in order to be shot?
He said he owed you a debt of honour, and he does.
Melton stood up, dusting the knees of his breeches, and turned to his lieutenant, who had been watching the questioning with considerable bewilderment.
It's the deuce of a situation, Wallace. This Jacobite scut is famous. You've heard of Red Jamie, the one on the broadsheets.
The lieutenant nodded, looking curiously down at the bedraggled form in the dirt at his feet. Melton smiled bitterly.
No, he doesn't look so dangerous now, does he? But he's still Red Jamie Fraser, and his grace would be more than pleased to hear of such an illustrious prisoner. They haven't yet found Charles Stuart, but a few well-known Jacobites would please the crowds at Tower Hill nearly as much.
Shall I send a message to his grace?
The lieutenant reached for his message box.
No.
Melton wheeled to glare down at his prisoner.
That's the difficulty. Besides being prime gallows bait, this filthy wretch is also the man who captured my youngest brother near Preston, and rather than shooting the brat, which is what he deserved, spared his life and returned him to his companions. Thus, he said, through his teeth, incurring a bloody great debt of honour upon my family. Dear me, said the lieutenant. So you can't give him to his grace after all. No, blast it. I can't even shoot the bastard without dishonouring my brother's sworn word.
The prisoner opened one eye.
I will not tell anyone if you don't, he suggested,
and promptly closed it again.
Shut up!
Losing his temper entirely, Melton kicked the prisoner, who grunted at the impact, but said nothing more.
Perhaps we could shoot him under an assumed name, the lieutenant suggested helpfully.
Lord Melton gave his aide a look of withering scorn, then looked out the window to judge the time.
It'll be dark in 3 hours. I'll oversee the burial of the other executed prisoners. Find a small wagon and have it filled with hay. Find a driver. Pick someone discreet, Wallace. That means bribeable, Wallace. And have them here as soon as it's dark. Yes, sir. Sir, what about the prisoner?
The lieutenant gestured diffidently toward the body on the floor.
What about him? Melton said brusquely. He's too weak to crawl, let alone walk. He isn't going anywhere. At least, not until the wagon gets here.
Wagon? The prisoner was showing signs of life. In fact, under the stimulus of agitation, he had managed to raise himself onto one arm. Bloodshot blue eyes gleamed wide with alarm under the spikes of matted red hair.
Where are you sending me?
Turning from the door, Melton cast him a glance of intense dislike.
You're the Laird of Broch Turach, aren't you? Well, that's what I'm sending you. I don't want to go home. I want to be shot.
The Englishman exchanged a look.
Raving,
the lieutenant said significantly, and Melton nodded.
I doubt he'll live through the journey, but his death won't be on my head, at least.
The door shut firmly behind the Englishman, leaving Jamie Fraser quite alone and still alive. Chapter 2. The Hunt Begins. Inverness, May the 2nd, 1968.
Of course he's dead.
Claire's voice was sharp with agitation. It rang loudly in the half-empty study, echoing among the rifled bookshelves. She stood against the cork-lined wall like a prisoner awaiting a firing squad, staring from her daughter to Roger Wakefield and back again.
I don't think so.
Roger felt terribly tired. He rubbed a hand over his face, then picked up the folder from the desk, the one containing all the research he'd done since Claire and her daughter had first come to him 3 weeks before and asked his help. He opened the folder and thumbed slowly through the contents. The Jacobites of Culloden. The rising of the 45. The gallant Scots who had rallied to the banner of Bonnie Prince Charlie and cut through Scotland like a blazing sword, only to come to ruin and defeat against the Duke of Cumberland on the Grey Moor at Culloden. "Here," he said, plucking out several sheets clipped together. The archaic writing looked odd, rendered in the black crispness of a photocopy. "This is the muster roll of the Master of Lovat's regiment." He thrust the thin sheaf of papers at Clare. But it was her daughter, Brianna, who took the sheets from him and began to turn the pages, a slight frown between her reddish brows.
"Read the top sheet," Roger said, "where it says officers."
"All right.
Officers," she read aloud. "Simon, Master of Lovat." "The young fox," Roger interrupted. "Lovat's son. And five more names, right?"
Brianna cocked one brow at him, but went on reading.
"William Chisholm Fraser, Lieutenant. George Damer Fraser Shaw, Captain. Duncan Joseph Fraser, Lieutenant. Bayard Murray Fraser, Major."
She paused, swallowing, before reading the last name.
"James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser, Captain."
She lowered the papers, looking a little pale.
"My father."
Clare moved quickly to her daughter's side, squeezing the girl's arm. She was pale too.
"Yes," she said to Roger. "I know he went to Culloden. When he left me, there at the Stone Circle, he meant to go back to Culloden Field to rescue his men who were with Charles Stuart. And we know he did." She nodded at the folder on the desk, its manila surface blank and innocent in the lamplight. "You found their names. But Jamie..."
Speaking the name aloud seemed to rattle her, and she clamped her lips tight. Now it was Brianna's turn to support her mother.
"He meant to go back, you said."
Her eyes, dark blue and encouraging, were intent on her mother's face.
"He meant to take his men away from the field and then go back to the battle."
Clare nodded, recovering herself slightly.
"He knew he hadn't much chance of getting away, if the English caught him. He said he'd rather die in battle. That's what he meant to do."
She turned to Roger, her gaze an unsettling amber. Her eyes always reminded him of hawk's eyes, as though she could see a good deal farther than most people.
"I can't believe he didn't die there.
So many men did, and he meant to." Almost half the Highland army had died at Culloden, cut down in a blast of cannon fire and searing musketry.
But not Jamie Fraser.
"No," Roger said doggedly. "That bit I read you from Linklater's book."
He reached to pick it up, a white volume entitled The Prince in the Heather.
"Following the battle," he read, 18 wounded Jacobite officers took refuge in the farmhouse near the moor. Here they lay in pain, their wounds untended, for 2 days. At the end of that time they were taken out and shot. One man, a Fraser of the Master of Lovat's regiment, escaped the slaughter. The rest are buried at the edge of the domestic park.
See?" he said,
laying the book down and looking earnestly at the two women over its pages.
"An officer of the Master of Lovat's regiment."
He grabbed up the sheets of the muster roll.
"And here they are, just 6 of them. Now, we know the man in the farmhouse can't have been young Simon. He's a well-known historical figure, and we know very well what happened to him. He retreated from the field, unwounded, mind you, with a group of his men, and fought his way north, eventually making it back to Beaufort Castle near here."
He waved vaguely at the full-length window, through which the night-time lights of Inverness twinkled faintly.
"Nor was the man who escaped Lianach Farmhouse any of the other 4 officers, William, George, Duncan, or Bayard," Roger said. "Why?"
He snatched another paper out of the folder and brandished it almost triumphantly.
Because they all did die at Culloden. All four of them were killed on the field. I found their names listed on a plaque at the church in Bewley.
Claire let out a long breath, then eased herself down into the old leather swivel chair behind the desk.
"Jesus H. Christ," she said.
She closed her eyes and leaned forward, elbows on the desk, and her head against her hands, the thick, curly brown hair spilling forward to hide her face. Brianna laid a hand on Claire's back, face troubled as she bent over her mother. She was a tall girl with large, fine bones, and her long red hair glowed in the warm light of the desk lamp.
"If he didn't die," she began tentatively.
Claire's head snapped up.
"But he is dead," she said.
Her face was strained, and small lines were visible around her eyes.
"For God's sake! It's 200 years! Whether he died at Culloden or not, he's dead now."
Brianna stepped back from her mother's vehemence and lowered her head so the red hair, her father's red hair, swung down beside her cheek.
"I guess so," she whispered.
Roger could see she was fighting back tears.
"No wonder," he thought.
To find out in short order that first, the man you had loved and called father all your life really wasn't your father. Secondly, that your real father was a Highland Scot who had lived 200 years ago. And thirdly, to realize that he had likely perished in some horrid fashion, unthinkably far from the wife and child he had sacrificed himself to save. Enough to rattle one, Roger thought. He crossed to Brianna and touched her arm. She gave him a brief, distracted glance and tried to smile. He put his arms around her, even in his pity for her distress, thinking how marvellous she felt, all warm and soft and springy at once. Claire still sat at the desk, motionless. The yellow hawk's eyes had gone a softer colour now, remote with memory. They rested sightlessly on the east wall of the study, still covered from floor to ceiling with the notes and memorabilia left by the Reverend Wakefield, Roger's late adoptive father. Looking at the wall himself, Roger saw the annual meeting notice sent by the Society of the White Rose, those enthusiastic, eccentric souls who still championed the cause of Scottish independence, meeting in nostalgic tribute to Charles Stuart and the Highland heroes who had followed him. Roger cleared his throat slightly.
If Jamie Fraser didn't die at Culloden, he said,
then he likely died soon afterward.
Claire's eyes met Roger's, straight on, the cool look back in the yellow-brown depths.
You have no idea how it was, she said. There was a famine in the Highlands. None of the men had eaten for days before the battle. He was wounded. We know that. Even if he escaped, there would have been no one to care for him.
Her voice caught slightly at that. She was a doctor now, had been a healer even then 20 years before, when she had stepped through a circle of standing stones, and met destiny with James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser. Roger was conscious of them both, the tall, shaking girl he held in his arms, and the woman at the desk, so still, so poised. She had travelled through the stones, through time, been suspected as a spy, arrested as a witch, snatched by an unimaginable quirk of circumstance from the arms of her first husband, Frank Randall. And 3 years later, her second husband, James Fraser, had sent her back through the stones, pregnant, in a desperate effort to save her and the unborn child from the onrushing disaster that would soon engulf him.
Surely, he thought to himself, she's been through enough.
But Roger was a historian.
He had a scholar's insatiable, amoral curiosity, too powerful to be constrained by simple compassion. More than that, he was oddly conscious of the third figure in the family tragedy in which he found himself involved, Jamie Fraser.
"If he didn't die at Culloden," he began again more firmly, "then perhaps I can find out what did happen to him. Do you want me to try?"
He waited, breathless, feeling Brianna's warm breath through his shirt. Jamie Fraser had had a life and a death. Roger felt obscurely that it was his duty to find out all the truth, that Jamie Fraser's women deserved to know all they could of him. For Brianna, such knowledge was all she would ever have of the father she had never known. And for Claire, behind the question he had asked was the thought that had plainly not yet struck her, stunned with shock as she was. She had crossed the barrier of time twice before. She could, just possibly, do it again. And if Jamie Fraser had not died at Culloden... He saw awareness flicker in the clouded amber of her eyes as the thought came to her. She was normally pale. Now her face blanched, white as the ivory handle of the letter opener before her on the desk. Her fingers closed around it, clenching, so the knuckles stood out in knobs of bone. She didn't speak for a long time. Her gaze fixed on Brianna and lingered there for a moment, then returned to Roger's face. "Yes," she said, in a whisper so soft he could barely hear her. "Yes. Find out for me. Please. Find out." Chapter 3. Frank and Full Disclosure. Inverness, May the 9th, 1968. The foot traffic was heavy on the bridge over the River Ness, with folk streaming home to their teas. Roger moved in front of me, his wide shoulders protecting me from the buffets of the crowd around us. I could feel my heart beating heavily against the stiff cover of the book I was clutching to my chest. It did that whenever I paused to think what we were truly doing. I wasn't sure which of the two possible alternatives was worse. To find that Jamie had died at Culloden, or to find that he hadn't. The boards of the bridge echoed hollowly underfoot as we trudged back toward the manse. My arms ached from the weight of the books I carried, and I shifted the load from one side to the other.
"Watch your bloody wheel, man!" Roger shouted, nudging me adroitly to the side as a working man on a bicycle ploughed head downward through the bridge traffic, nearly running me against the railing.
"Sorry,"
came back the apologetic shout,
and the rider gave a wave of the hand over his shoulder as the bike wove its way between two groups of schoolchildren coming home for their teas. I glanced back across the bridge in case Brianna should be visible behind us, but there was no sign of her. Roger and I had spent the afternoon at the Society for the Preservation of Antiquities. Brianna had gone down to the Highland Clans office, there to collect photocopies of a list of documents Roger had compiled.
"It's very kind of you to take all this trouble, Roger," I said, raising my voice to be heard above the echoing bridge and the river's rush. "It's all right," he said, a little awkwardly, pausing for me to catch him up. "I'm curious," he added, smiling a little. "You know historians. Can't leave a puzzle alone."
He shook his head, trying to brush the wind-blown dark hair out of his eyes without using his hands.
I did know historians. I'd lived with one for 20 years.
Frank hadn't wanted to leave this particular puzzle alone either, but neither had he been willing to solve it. Frank had been dead for 2 years, though, and now it was my turn, mine and Brianna's.
"Have you heard yet from Dr. Linklater?" I asked as we came down the arch of the bridge.
Late in the afternoon as it was, the sun was still high, so far north as we were. Caught among the leaves of the lime trees on the river bank,
It glowed pink on the granite cenotaph that stood below the bridge. Roger shook his head, squinting against the wind.
No, but it's been only a week since I wrote. If I don't hear by the Monday, I'll try telephoning. Don't worry.
He smiled sideways at me.
I was very circumspect. I just told him that for purposes of a study I was making, I needed a list, if one existed, of the Jacobite officers who were in Leonach farmhouse after Culloden, and if any information exists as to the survivor of that execution, could he refer me to the original sources?
"Do you know Linklater?" I asked, easing my left arm by tilting the book sideways against my hip.
"No, but I wrote my request on the Balliol College letterhead and made tactful reference to Mr. Cheesewright, my old tutor, who does know Linklater."
Roger winked reassuringly, and I laughed. His eyes were a brilliant, lucent green, bright against his olive skin. Curiosity might be his stated reason for helping us to find out Jamie's history, but I was well aware that his interest went a good bit deeper, in the direction of Brianna. I also knew that the interest was returned. What I didn't know was whether Roger realized that as well. Back in the late Reverend Wakefield's study, I dropped my armload of books on the table in relief and collapsed into the wing chair by the hearth while Roger went to fetch a glass of lemonade from the manse's kitchen. My breathing slowed as I sipped the tart sweetness, but my pulse stayed erratic as I looked over the imposing stack of books we had brought back. Was Jamie in there somewhere? And if he was? My hands grew wet on the cold glass, and I choked the thought off. Don't look too far ahead, I cautioned myself. Much better to wait and see what we might find. Roger was scanning the shelves in the study, in search of other possibilities. The Reverend Wakefield, Roger's late adoptive father, had been both a good amateur historian and a terrible pack rat. Letters, journals, pamphlets and broadsheets, antique and contemporary volumes, were all crammed cheek by jowl together on the shelves. Roger hesitated, then his hand fell on a stack of books sitting on the nearby table. They were Frank's books. An impressive achievement, so far as I could tell, by reading the encomiums printed on the dust jackets.
"Have you ever read this?" he asked, picking up the volume entitled The Jacobites.
"No," I said. I took a restorative gulp of lemonade and coughed.
"No,"
I said again. "I couldn't." After my return, I had resolutely refused to look at any material dealing with Scotland's past, even though the 18th century had been one of Frank's areas of specialty. Knowing Jamie dead, and faced with the necessity of living without him, I avoided anything that might bring him to mind. A useless avoidance. There was no way of keeping him out of my mind, with Brianna's existence a daily reminder of him. But still, I couldn't read books about the Bonnie Prince, that terrible, futile young man, or his followers.
I see. I just thought you might know whether there might be something useful in here.
Roger paused, the flush deepening over his cheekbones.
Did your husband, Frank, I mean, he added hastily, did you tell him, about...
His voice trailed off, choked with embarrassment.
"Well, of course I did," I said a little sharply. "What did you think? I'd just stroll back into his office after being gone for 3 years and say, 'Oh, hello there, darling, and what would you like for supper tonight?"
"No, of course not," Roger muttered. He turned away, eyes fixed on the bookshelves. The back of his neck was deep red with embarrassment. "I'm sorry," I said, taking a deep breath. "It's a fair question to ask. It's only that it's a bit raw yet." A good deal more than a bit. I was both surprised and appalled to find just how raw the wound still was. I set the glass down on the table at my elbow. If we were going on with this, I was going to need something stronger than lemon.